okay, for this presentation, I'm going to pretend that I'm in a class and I'm teaching something. So if the things that I'm teaching is too simple, forgive me. I'm going to pretend that you're, for example, student or something like that. And that's pretty much how my classes go. That's pretty much how I teach. Okay. The presentation is called the rule of all. And definitely it's about a ruler that falls. The observation is, if you lean a ruler against the wall, then it still leans and falls. And more slowly, we see this. Okay. We can repeat this observation with a computer, but every time the previous frames remain, you see? The ruler falls and the previous ones remain. So more slowly, I'm sketching 10 of them, but it can be, you know, if you have a fast camera, you can take a lot of pictures, for example, infinite number of them. And if you look more closer, you can see there's a kind of curve here. If the number of these are infinite, so this will be a smooth curve called an envelope or something like that. So we will try to find out the equation describing this curve. Okay, we'll go through some examples. Our first example is about an ink drop. For example, an ink is thrown with some certain velocity in some, with some initial angle, and with the same velocity in different angles, with various angles, the initial velocity is the same. Okay? So if there are inks, so they will leave marks on the wall or something like that, and you can see that there is another curve here that we're going to find out its equation. So if these are infinite number of these, so the curve will be very smooth. It's just 10 of them. Okay. So the process we're going through is like this, like an algorithm. First, choose an arbitrary x0, and then choose a parameter that uniquely determines one of the curves. That given one, given this parameter, it only determines one curve, one of those infinite number of curves. Okay? So in this problem, it is theta. Given one initial angle, you only get one of these curves. You change them, you get another curve. Okay? So then, you have an arbitrary x0, a curve with some specific theta passes some h in your x0. Okay? It will be pretty much like this. If you choose an x0 and with some angle, this is the hint you get. Okay? So, we express the y at that x0 in terms of the parameter, which is theta. And then, it's, you have to maximize it. We'll tell you why. You have to maximize it in terms of theta, which means taking the derivative and equating it to zero, and find that parameter, which is here, arctangent tangent of v0 squared on gx0. Okay, then you put this theta in the previous equation, and you get y in terms of x0, and eliminating the zero in this index, you will get the, what do you call, the equation. So, for the first example, this is x0 we choose, and then among all of these curves, there is one curve that has the most y in this x0, say this curve that just turned red. Okay, so this is the final point that will contribute to the final envelope. So we keep this among all of the curves, we keep this maximum y, and this will be the y at the final equation. So we call this y of x, which x is x0. Eliminate the zero index. Okay? So that's pretty much how it works. Here's a nice sketch before all these figures. And the final equation is, as you all are aware, it's again, I forgot, hyperbola? Okay. It's a hyperbola. So if you have a lid, if you have a lid with this shape and you put it on the ink thrower, it will be all filled with ink, but it cannot be touched. For our second example, there's a kind of, you know, if you connect 9 to 1, 8 to 2, 7 to 3, and so on, you will get a nice shape. I don't know what's that shape called, or whether it has a specific meaning or something like that. But you get a, if the number of these are infinite, you will get a smooth curve again, whose shape we're gonna try to find out. So, what's this curve? As our second example. Again, following the same procedure, we choose an arbitrary x0, again, and choose a parameter here, which I tend to choose the a parameter called y0. That's, I'm going to describe what it is in the figure. Y0 is this. So as the sum of this and this is always constant, it will be uniquely determined. So the line, given this and this, the line will be uniquely determined. So given one y0, there is only one line, not two of them. Okay? And then we'll express express y of x0 in terms of y0. And then, as you all remember, we will try to maximize this. We'll take derivative and equate it to zero to get the maximum height, which will contribute to the final envelope. And the answer is this. Putting this y in here instead of, I forgot the zero, instead of y0, you get the final equation for the envelope. So, here's another nice sketch for all these. The final equation is this. Which is nice. I don't know why it doesn't have any names, like circle or hyperbola. But I like this, because it's nice looking. It's like a circle or not. Okay, so getting back to our original problem, which was a rod or a ruler falling, we again follow the same algorithm. We choose a x0, and then for the parameter in this problem, I think it's easier to go with theta. Because the length of the rod is constant, and given one, given a theta, you only get one line, okay? You don't have two situations with one theta. So again, we express y of that x0 we have chosen, in terms of the parameter we've chosen, which is theta. And it's simple, because it's a line, you have the slope, it's theta, and also you have this height, which we have to add. So it's a line equation, it's very simple, right? And then we'll take derivative of this and equate it to zero, again, just to obtain the maximum y that all of these lines can pass through a point with zero. And the answer is this. And you put this theta in this equation, and you get the final solution. So, for the final solution, the equation of the envelope is, I'm showing you another nice sketch of four of these, which is somehow interesting. The final solution is here. This is. Okay. So we have learned a procedure to work on with these problems. And you probably learned how to do it. So, as our final thing, we get an exercise. Suppose that we have a vessel or something like that filled with water to the height of a capital H, and you make a hole in its wall that water can, you know, stay. And suppose that the velocity, initial velocity, is horizontal. And it's equal to square root of 2gh, which h is the distance between this and the surface of the water, not from the ground, okay? So the water drops come like this horizontally and then hit the floor. And then suppose that instead of one of these holes, we make a lot of these holes, okay? So forget about the variation of this h, okay? It's, for example, 10 of them. You see, we will get another curve. So if the number of these are infinite, this curve will be smooth and will have an equation. So, as you all know, the procedure that you must go through, I've already spent 9.5 minutes. So, I will give you 1 minute, and whoever does this in 1 minute gets $20. That's exactly what I do in my classes. So, your 1 minute starts now. I'm serious, it's $20. Five seconds. Ten seconds. Come on, people, wake up.
15 seconds.
$25 seconds.
If everybody gets it,
this
is going to cost you a
lot of money.
Well,
no, the first person. It doesn't matter, it's just
$20. It's worth it because...
It means that they've learned it, and they've tried. This is why my students keep their energy to the end of the class, because they know this is going to happen. 40 seconds.
You've got 20 seconds, people.
Come on. 50 seconds. Fifty-six. And that is the end. I'm going to show you the answer. Using this. And you may be surprised by the answer. Okay. It's for 10 holes in the wall. And this is for 100 of them. And the next one is for 1,000 of them. It's a line. The curve is a line. Okay. So, I didn't expect it. Okay, thanks for your attention. It is a joke I make every time. Thank you for listening.
We have time for a very, very short question. Tell us.
Actually, just a comment. That curve that you're
on
is called an asteroid.
I don't know.
That curve you like is called an asteroid.
Asteroid? Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, we should move on to the next
asteroid.
One.
Asteroid. I don't know. I'm going to pull my skirt now. I hope that doesn't happen. Heather, it's up at the top, PDF.
Can start.
Be quiet. Starting now. All right. So today I'm going to be talking about the different colors we see in the sky. So I'm going to start with telling you why the sky is colored at all. I'll then go on to why the color changes when we have sunrises and sunsets. And finally, I'll go on to what can affect the different colors of the sky at sunrise or sunset. So, why isn't the sky white? I mean, we have a continuous spectrum coming from the sun. The light is scattered, but we see blue. So this happens with a phenomenon called Rayleigh scattering. Now, Rayleigh scattering says the intensity of the light we see is proportional to 1 over the wavelength to the fourth power. So basically what this means is that we see shorter wavelengths to a much higher intensity than long wavelengths. So I did a little calculation here. If you use red to 750 nanometers and blue is 450 nanometers, you end up with an intensity ratio of 1 to 8. That is, we see blue light 8 times more intensely than red light. So if you look here, you can see why we actually have blue all around the sky. So that's not right at us. The blue is actually scattered all the way around the sky. So while you do have red and green wavelengths making it straight through to an observer, the red and green is not scattered all the way around. So here, you only get the blue. So we established that short wavelengths are scattered more. Why isn't the sky violet? It actually has to do with our eyes and eye sensitivity. Now, we know we see with cones in our eyes, right? That's why how we perceive color. We have 3 different cones, one for long wavelengths, one for medium wavelengths, and one for short wavelengths. And if you look at the short wavelength peak, you see that we actually are most spectrally sensitive at blue light, but by the time you get to violet, it's not very sensitive at all. So it's not that the sky isn't violet, it's simply that we don't see it as such, because we can't. It's just why we don't see ultraviolet light. It's the same thing. So now let's look more towards the sun. It's always brighter. You see the darker blues farther away from the sun, but if you look straight towards the sun, I don't advise this, it's much brighter, right? So longer wavelengths are present when you're closer to the sun because they're coming straight through. They don't have to be scattered much. The sky appears brighter now because all wavelengths are present. So you know how you get white light. It's the sum of all colors. So you have all wavelengths coming through, and then a little bit of scattered blue is what gives it a little bit of a blue tinge. And the sun itself appears white or yellowish because the spectral output of the sun is slightly yellow. So now let's look at this a little more deep. If we take a sample, a color sample from a photograph, the sun is somewhere over here, and we analyze these, you can see that we do, closer to the sun, we do have more red and green. I've normalized this so that blue is in a relative intensity of 1, and I normalized these with respect to the blue. So you can see the farther you get from the sun, you actually do have less red and green light. This is good. It supports the theory. So what about sunlight, sunrise and sunset? What's happening here? So when the sun is lower on the horizon, particles have to travel through significantly more atmosphere to reach an observer. So basically this means that the longer wavelengths are traveling far enough through the atmosphere to have some time to scatter. It's kind of think about it in terms of probabilities. If you have enough atmosphere, the light's eventually going to scatter. So, but what else happens here? Light scatters off different sizes of molecules, right? We have me scattering is what makes clouds. But particles in the air can actually affect the color of sunrise or sunset, unlike clouds, which are just white. These include salt from the ocean, dust from passing storms, low-lying clouds or fog, or haze and smog. So dust itself can create a redder sky. This might not be intuitive, but think about what happens when you have storms. If you have a big passing storm, it kicks up a lot of dust into the sky, and you get a redder sunset. Now, on the eastern seaboard, storms often pass in the same direction as sun rising and setting, so from east to west. And this actually is where the old adage is, red sky in morning, sailor take warning, red sky at night, sailor's delight, because a passing storm would actually be in the direction of the sun. Now, the main pollutants over eastern North America are sulfates. And sulfates are hygroscopic, so in the air, they attract water, and they'll form small particles just like clouds. However, sometimes these particles can be all of the same size. It's rare, but it's more common than with clouds and water droplets. So if they are all the same diameter, you can get a cloud that will scatter a certain wavelength of light, because me scattering does depend a little bit on the wavelength. So you can get a tint in the sky, but never anything that really brightens. It's usually a dull tint. Now, we know that clouds are white, right, during the day. They're not blue. However, at sunset, sunrise, you can get red clouds, orange clouds, pink clouds, yellow clouds. So what's happening here? Now, when a cloud captures white light, what it's doing is it's taking all the rays from the sun and it's scattering all of the light together. If you have a cloud that it's at sunset, the blue light is so effectively scattered away that red light and yellow light are all kind of what's left. And if you have a cloud that's high enough in the atmosphere so that the light's not scattered, it actually will capture that red and that yellow light, and you'll end up with a very brilliant cloud. Now, short wavelengths are so successfully scattered that they don't reach the clouds, and that's what happens with that blue light. So that's why you don't actually end up with blue clouds at any time of the day. So, in conclusion, the day sky appears blue because of Rayleigh scattering. When the sun is low on the horizon, the longer wavelengths are scattered, leaving the color in the sky. And particulates in the sky can either tint the sky or create a faded pastel appearance. And of course, if you have clouds above the upper boundary atmospheric boundary layer, they will capture the light of the sun. Thanks. Any questions? You do see a continuous change in color, actually. If you go here, this is actually sunrise. But if you look here, you do get green-tinted sky occasionally, not so much green, but you do see the yellow. and you do see orange, right? And earlier on, this would have been different colors. You do get a continuous spectrum. Yeah?
Is it quite quick because of the power of 4 in the Rayleigh scattering?
Yes.
So, I'm just guessing, but maybe it does very rapidly switch from blue to red because it's so powerful.
Oh, the change, yeah. I don't have a good picture. I couldn't find one in my photos of one that had a good change. But if you look at one where there's no clouds at all, you will see the horizon, a red band, yellow band, little green band, and then blue. You can find a lot of them. I can show you one later if you want. Somebody else? Yeah?
Green sky is often associated with tornadoes or plane-based sensing. Is that accurately highlighted or self-just fiction? If so, why would it be green?
I don't know anything about tornadoes. I live by the ocean. But I know green sky can be associated with other things, just flares in the sky of green, and I was reading about it, and all I read about it was that nobody knows why. So.
A little yellow, like the clouds that sort of turn to yellow green.
Yellow green. It probably is the same phenomenon you're thinking of. Yeah?
Okay. When you talk about the boundary layer of the atmosphere, how thick are we talking
about? Oh, it's just above the lower atmosphere. The atmospheric boundary layer is the layer just above the lowest layer of the atmosphere where the dust and particulates hang. So it's where there's still actual atmosphere, but just the boundary within it, above which you don't have all that dust and smog and stuff. Anything else? Yeah?
It sounds like different from the sunrise. They look different.
Pardon me? I can't hear you. Can you speak up?
Do sunsets and sunrises are...
Yes.
They look different?
Yeah, slightly. And that's because during the day it's warmer. So you get more dust and you get more dissolved particles in the air, more water vapor. So yeah, sunsets are often more obscured. You'll have the haze, right? And it makes it a little more washed out than it would if it were sunrise when you have morning. It's been cold all day, stuff can settle, and you'll end up with a more brilliant sky. Yeah?
Smog always looks brown.
Yeah, it's like a purpley reddish haze.
Yeah, it's just smog, so maybe it's just your own psychology, but it looks dirty, right?
Yeah.
Is that just literally particulates that are in the air that are making it look brown?
It is. It is usually sulfates forming particles, and it is because they do form particles and dust of the same size, so it'll give a slight, it is a reddish tint. Yeah. All right. Oh, more questions.
Yes, one more question. When you put that saying about red sky at night, you have it with shepherds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I always know sailors, but yeah, it is shepherds too, or travelers. I've heard it there too.
So
I read it.
Does it originate from
sailors? I don't know when it originates from. That's just what I grew up hearing, which is strange because on the West Coast they don't have storms that go that way; they go the other direction. It doesn't make sense, but it originates on the eastern seaboard of the United States, from what I was reading.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Probably all noticed many, many times, which is that a lot of surfaces look darker when they're wet. So I think this is something that I've always, you know, thought about and wondered about off and on for many, many years, but it never really occurred to me until now that I could actually just go look it up and figure out why it happens. So it's just kind of my chance to do that. So, here's a picture that was taken sort of by that waterfall that's over by the big building. And it's a stone with sort of some mud on it, and whether it's the stone or the dirt that looks slightly darker when it's wet there in the middle doesn't particularly matter because it's the same principle roughly for both. So an outline of my talk. First, I'm going to sort of motivate it beyond just the inherent interest of the topic, and then I'll go through the explanation that Engström gave, and then I will talk about some modifications that were made to that explanation. And of course, last, I will conclude. So beyond just the fact that it's that I was curious. the issue of like surface albedo, right, is really important environmentally because it influences the climate. You know, you have a large bit of dark terrain, so whether it's dark because it's wet or for other reasons, you're going to absorb more energy. So it's just kind of, I was thinking that if we can figure out, you know, exactly not just that it gets darker obviously when it's wet, but how much it gets darker when it's wet, then that's a useful thing to apply to say climate modeling or something. Okay, so why does this happen? Engström's explanation was, first of all, this happens mostly with rough surfaces, right? So like with rocks or soil or clothing, not shiny clothing, not like a raincoat, it doesn't happen because that's a really shiny, smooth surface, but on something like a stone. So that can be described by what's called a Lambertian surface, which reflects diffusely. So if you have a beam of light coming in, we model that by saying it reflects equally in all directions. So this is the model. Now we have, you know, if we have a surface with a layer of fluid on top of it, say water, the light will come in, reflect diffusely off the rough surface shown there at the bottom, and then it'll bounce back up. But what happens with that layer of fluid is that you have this extra optical interface now. So when the light goes up, it may hit the water at such an angle that it's totally internally reflected. So in other words, some of the light doesn't make it back up to the air and then to the observer. So less total radiation coming out of the surface. Right, so that's kind of just the basics of Engström's explanation. So here's another picture of that, just sort of the same thing. You can see within theta C there is the critical angle. So beyond that angle, all the light's stuck inside the layer of water. The modification that was made was basically to say, okay, so yes, we have this light that's trapped in because of total internal reflection, but also you have light, obviously, that's bouncing back even when it's, you know, even where the light is being transmitted, part of it is bouncing back. So that was something that was left out for some reason of Engström's explanation. So that doesn't change it intuitively too much, but it does change the math of it. In other words, Engström's theory underestimated how much light was trapped in that layer of water. But also, another thing that Engström didn't consider was the fact that the absorption between, if we go back to this picture, so the absorption between the liquid and the rough surface is going to be higher than it would be if we were talking about the absorption between air and a rough surface, because the index of refraction of water, right, is above one, whereas for air it's about one. So probably the water's index of refraction is closer to the rocks, so less difference in index of refraction. There's going to be less reflection, more absorption. So that's really the main thing. So that's another instance where even less light will ever escape to the air, because more of it's getting absorbed. So in conclusion, rough surfaces are darker when they're wet because of total internal reflection, because of the reflection that occurs, the partial reflection, as well as because of the higher absorption of the rough surface when it's wet than when it's exposed to the air. Yeah, sorry. The main reason you get reflection, right, when you have an optical interface between two mediums with different index of refraction, right? So the closer they are together, the less reflection you get. So the difference between air's index of refraction and a rock's index of refraction is going to be a greater difference than the difference between water's index of refraction and rock's index of refraction. Yeah, that's all it is. I'm sure it does. I mean, certainly, but I haven't had the chance to get into it much. I mean, you've got, like, there are many orders of when you do it mathematically. You've got, you know, so the parts that bounce back into the water then hit the surface, and then they're again reflected diffusely. So then you've got some that will escape that time. So you've got, like, orders and orders of magnitude. So I imagine it would come into that, maybe, just in...
Yeah, I mean, the reason I ask is because I was thinking about when you're drawing something or you're watching a spot fly,
yeah.
It's how long it takes it to disappear.
Right.
You know, it's like... It happens abruptly after a long time.
Yeah, and that kind of reminded me of something else that I was wondering about, maybe, like, future investigations. So maybe you guys know, like, when you have some surfaces, when you first get them wet, the water seems to sort of sit on top, but it doesn't change it. But then it's only when it absorbs that it seems to change the color. So I don't know exactly what's going on there. But.
I was thinking about clothes.
Yeah.
When you're watering clothes, they seem to have a different color. It's the same kind of
effect. Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I mean, I've certainly seen it referred to as being the same effect, and I was assuming it was, but I don't know. Probably not, sorry. Wait. Oh. No, sorry.
So hello, my name is Sebastian, and I'm going to talk about instant cooling solutions. So the thing is, my main motivation is when you're in the summer and you come from a cold place like I do, or at least Bogota has a mild weather. So the hot and humid weather we have here in summer is like unbearable for us. So when you don't have AC, what do? You can put on wet clothes. You can try minty products, you know, like menthol sprays and all those things. You can try, like, eating spicy food, for example. If you eat spicy food, you will sweat more, and that way you get cooler. And there are other things you can do, but I'm going to concentrate on these two techniques. Using a fan and pucker your lips and blow. Like, when you have a bowl of soup and you want to cool it down, you just do that. Okay. So... fans. What is a fan? Well, a fan is just like any flat and lightweight surface you can like wave back and forth. And it's like very intuitive, you know. It has been used for many years and almost everyone like uses a fan intuitively. So how does it work? Well, you know, the fans actually don't cool the air. You just move the air around. So it just like increases the airflow over your skin, so it helps natural evaporation. And it also can help like do forced convection, for example, inside a big room. But I'm not going to focus. I'm just going to talk about the evaporation part. So this is the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. This is for a ideal gas. So we're talking about water, so it's not the same, but it's roughly the same idea. You have like a temperature dependence, and even though the average kinetic energy depends on temperature, there are some particles that actually have a high kinetic energy. They have high velocities. So these particles, when they are near the surface of the liquid, they can just escape if they have enough energy. So this is roughly what you have here. Here is the light blues. It's like, in this case, it's your skin. The liquid will be your sweat. And it starts evaporating, and you have like a vapor forming. So when you use a fan, you actually are like moving the air and like drier air comes near you and humid air just goes away. So in that way, if you do it like fast enough, you won't reach equilibrium situation, and you have a distribution more or less like this. Like you won't have the faster molecules, and in that way you will lower the average kinetic energy of the fluid, and in that way it actually gets cooler. The sweat gets cooler, and you reduce the temperature. Okay, so as you see, the airflow produced by fans actually reduces the concentration of water around you, and that's why you feel cooler. And okay, of course, sweat is mainly water, and it has a large heat capacity, so it's just like absorbing heat from your skin, from your skin, and cooling your body. Okay, now blowing cool air. When you have something hot, you just poke your lips and blow hard. You produce like this, like concentrated air stream, and you feel it like cool. If you try to blow into your hand, for example, you feel it that it is cooler. So some people try to explain this, saying that it's a gas that expands adiabatically, but it's wrong, because this equation is not exact. But basically, if you do the calculation using like one atmosphere for the external pressure and a rough temperature using your body and all those things, you arrive that you actually have to blow very hard. You have to like produce a pressure that is greater than one atmosphere. So it's very difficult for a human being to actually blow that hard. And if you try, you can see that you don't have to blow very hard to actually produce the cooling effect. So the key word here is forced convection. You actually are moving the air, and it's a principle that is similar to the fan. You are the faster moving air that you exhale, it moves the room air, and it provides a drier air stream. It just like move the humid air away and brings drier air. So the airflow increases the liquid's rate of evaporation, because as we saw, it just like takes the vapor away and it is fast enough. Okay, and if you analyze the air stream, it's just 40%. It is just constituted by the 40% of the air stream comes from your body, and 60% is ambient air. So that's why it's cooler also, because it is actually air room. And you can try, for example, if you put your hand near your mouth, it is very near, it will be warm. It won't be very cool. That's because it doesn't have like a lot of room air in it. But for example, if you use a straw, if you blow, you will see that it's actually warm, and it's because it doesn't have a lot of air room in it. Okay, so the main conclusion here is that there are several simple and handy solutions that you can do when you have to cool yourself and you have like AC around, and it's basically you just have to induce air flows around you so that sweat operates much faster. Okay, thank you.
So the way you explain it is that blowing takes away the vapor around you or the cup of coffee, and that allows more evaporation to take place, right? But say you have, I don't know, a hot piece of iron, and you blow on that, but then there's no vapor around it to start with, so would that cool down the hot piece of that?
I'm not quite sure. If you start blowing a hot piece of iron, I don't think it will cool that faster. I think it will be very different in the process. I think it will cool down by convection eventually, but if you blow, maybe you can force the convection, but it's a different process.
The heat transfer depends on the difference in temperatures between air above it and the hot metal. so the evaporation process won't take place, but because you're blowing cooler air over top, the heat transfers faster. So it's a different mechanism.
If there are any more questions, let's thank Sebastian.
Peter, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to assert the claim that nature knows some number theory. So first of all, I'm going to say, what number theory does it know? Well, it knows about the Fibonacci sequence. So the Fibonacci sequence is you take the first term as one, the second term is also one, and then every term after that is the sum of the previous two. And then you get this this series right here. We threw out the first one. And so what nature knows about this? Well, if you go into the woods and you pick up a pine cone and you look at it, and the scales on it form spirals in two directions, okay? And if you you can count the number of spirals in one direction, the red, and the number of spirals in the other direction, the green. And this isn't just true for pine cones. If you look at certain flowers like sunflowers, etc., you find this. You can count the spirals as well. So what is the claim? The claim is that when you count the number of spirals going one direction and you count the number of spirals going the other direction, the ratios are always going to be consecutive Fibonacci numbers. So consecutive numbers from the Fibonacci sequence. And this is true for various things. So for instance, if you pick up pine cones, for a certain type of pine cone, it's always going to be 8 to 13 under that tree. Or if you pick up a sunflower, it's always going to be 34 to 40, 55. And the name for this is phyllotaxis. And the question is, why does it happen? And this has been known for like ages. I think Da Vinci even wrote about it. And but this guy named Levitov in 91, he published some papers on it. And the reason why I chose this topic is because I heard about this this summer, and I was just really curious as to how on earth he connected, number theory to biology. I just wanted to see how it worked. So the argument is kind of involved. So please stay with me. So he starts out like this. So he only models pine cones, and he says that, let's say that they're a cylinder. So the spirals, so the scales in the pine cone are going to be lattices, vertices in the lattice on the cylinder. Okay, and so the lattices are all orthorhombic, meaning that they're made up of rhombi. And when you look at the two smallest vectors that make up the lattice, they're going to be the same size. That's because the scales are all the same size. And so a spiral on this lattice is modeled like so. So this is the height, and this is the angle. And the parameters h and alpha just characterize the lattice. Okay? The next thing that we're going to need to know is a Cayley tree. So a Cayley tree of coordination number n, in this case, coordination number 4, let's say, on these examples, is just something that, a graph that has the middle points are all connected to 4 other vertices. See, as in here. And the ones on the periphery are just connected to 1. So what's the main connection? The main connection is this graph. So this graph was found a long time ago. So it's you have the h on the vertical axis and the alpha on the horizontal axis. And what does it show? So each point here is a lattice because it's a pair, h alpha. And so these lines right here characterize orthorhombic lattices that have the following properties. So you count the number of spirals in one direction, the number of spirals in another direction, and the ratio is 1 to 2 here. This line right here corresponds to the same thing except 1 to 3. Here 1 to 4, here 2 to 5, and so on and so forth. And this was just found experimentally, like you, or numerically, I don't know. It was found in early 1900s. And these intersection points, the triangular lattices, we don't care about them. So what does he do? He wants to find some kind of energy function that characterizes the lattice. So he unrolls the cylinder, right, and writes down the lattice like this. So these are the points in the lattice. M and n are integers, And x and y, this is rescaled, and x and y are now the parameters. They've taken the role of h and alpha. Okay, so now let's look at an energy function of these two parameters, meaning an energy function of the lattice. So it's modeled like this. So you take just repulsive interaction that depends on the distance between two vertices. And you sum them up. You sum all of them up, and that's your energy. And so the idea is to minimize this energy for a certain lattice. And then the idea is to show that when the cone grows, it only follows this path right here. This path right here, notice, it's Fibonacci numbers. 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 5, 5, 8. Okay? So you want to show that. So what happens from this energy function? So for the u, he just takes, for specific u, he takes that one right there. But later you'll see that you can take any one. And so don't pay attention to the circles. Just pay attention to this thing right here. So you vary y, the parameter y, and you look at for which x, for that certain y, you have a minimum of the function e. And when you plot that out, you get this thing. You get these lines right here. Okay? Like it's a repetitive structure. And you have here a quasi-bifurcation, meaning that it splits for a certain value of y, but it doesn't split at the same point. Okay? And that's very important. So look at this line right here, and just look at the whole graph, and compare it to this one. So it looks very much, if you quasi-bifurcations were actually bifurcations, and the points touched, like here, it would be a very similar graph, and this path would be similar to this one. And we want to prove this. Okay, and how do we do it? We do it by comparing each graph to a third, and then just using the associative property. So the third graph is a Fairy graph. I don't know how to pronounce this. And I'm going to go through it kind of quickly because I don't have much time. But so you do it like this. You
4 minutes.
Okay. So it's just a way to construct all the rational numbers on the segment from 0 to 1. It's done in the following way. So you take one rational number, you add it like this to the other rational number, you get the third. Okay? So you add like 0 and 1, you get 1/2. You get this sequence. You add these two close to each other, you get 1/3 and 2/3, and you keep going and keep going, and you have this graph. So the hierarchy of this graph is important. So you have the newer rational numbers at the bottom, the old ones at the top. And furthermore, you can draw lines from each rational number to their parents. Okay, draw a thick line to the younger parent, and draw a dashed line to the older parent. Okay, and now let's look at the thick lines. So there's a quasi-bifurcation here again because you don't connect through the number. But let's say you did, okay, and it was a full bifurcation. Then this graph, it's exactly a Cayley tree with coordination number 3, and it goes downwards. So just by construction, it's the same thing as that one. So we don't need to prove anything there. We don't need to prove the equivalence to the first graph. We just need to prove the equivalence to the second graph. And how do we do that? Also, I'm going to kind of go through a bit quickly, but in short, you do this. On the energy graph, where there are minima, you draw these half circles. Half circles between rational numbers of this type and their Cayley sum, Fairy sum, but they have to obey this equality. And you get these things right here. And if you look at the minima graph, you see that the lines all go like this. Like you have one coming in from the top, one coming in here, and one going out here. And so I'm just going to show that on this graph, you see? And the thing is that this entire graph is made up of these non-straight triangles with the same thing in each one. So it's like a repetitive structure. The entire graph is made up of these things. Okay? And now let's go back to the Fairy graph, and you can see actually that this is the exact same thing. That the entire graph is made up of these triangles. You just have to move things around a little bit. I'm not going to go into how you move it. Like you move this thing up a little, and this up a little, and this up a little into this triangle. And then you can see that it's the exact same construction. So therefore, we show the equivalence between the minima graph and the Fairy graph. And also, as before I said, the Fairy graph is also initially just equivalent to the Cayley tree. And so we have this by association, this relationship, so that the minima graph, this line, is this figure is topologically equivalent to this one, except with the bifurcations. And this line is also topologically equivalent to this one. So the idea is that if our growth is modeled by a decrease in the variable y, then all of our pine cones will just go on this line and will stay on this Fibonacci sequence. Okay, and y is decrease in y. Why is that a good model for biological growth? Well, because the pine cone starts out initially as like the seed of the pine cone. It's very long and thin. It's made up of these long, thin embryos, head to tail. Okay, and so when they grow more horizontally than they do vertically. And so that corresponds to a decrease in the length to thickness ratio. But that is specifically what a decrease in y corresponds to. Because if you see here, you decrease y, and then your lattice, which initially was like mostly pointed upwards, now it spreads horizontally. Okay, the ratio between the lattice vectors is just like this one. So this is a good model for growth. And so here we've proven that decreasing y, when the pine cone grows, it follows this trajectory and it stays on the Fibonacci sequence. Also, what you have left to prove is that, you know, if you take a different repulsive interaction between two scales, that the topology will remain the same. And he does this in his other papers, but that explains why phyllotaxis is prevalent in nature, because, you know, it's not dependent on the exact form of the interaction. That's it. Any questions? What species is it? So I guess it grows. You see, it grows along this function. Like the y decreases. So like it's the ratio of its the seeds sort of grow in a certain sense. And at some point it stops growing. That corresponds to a certain y. That corresponds to a certain point h. Okay, and that means that you stop somewhere here on the graph. And so it just by how much it grows, I guess. I'm sure there's some other factors specific to the type of thing that you're looking at, like the type of cone or the type of flower. But the idea is just that it stays on this path. So whatever grows in that manner will end up on one of these segments.
A very short.
Just a comment, you know, there's theories of stock market behavior based on the Fibonacci series. It says that the patterns of stock prices follow, they reverse themselves in a sequence that's related to the Fibonacci series. So if you could find a good explanation for that, like you did with the pine cone, that would be very interesting.
He also applies this to like layered superconductors. So like there's vortices that appear in superconductors, and I guess they can be in different directions. And so you could also apply this there. He wrote a PRL on it.
We probably need to move on. So next talk speaker is Michael. Let's
second to last presentation. So I'm going to be talking about starburst today, which is a pretty lens flare. You can see in the picture there, a little star that I found in some of my pictures since I got a new camera. And, you know, I got curious. So I'm going to be talking about these odd effects I saw in my photos. I'm going to show them to you. I'm going to do a little detour through zoom lens optics and lens flares that happen in them. I'm going to track down why my stars have the number of points that they do, and talk about Fraunhofer diffraction and polygonal apertures. And then I'm going to look at other ways to achieve a similar effect and tell you what I learned from the project. So this is one of those pictures that I had, and you see that there's kind of star-shaped flare at a bright light source. similar thing happens with reflections off of water. And I thought they were really cool, but I really had no idea what they were. And it was really hard to actually find on the internet because there's a lot of, you know, photographer pages that don't really go into how these things happen. They talk about how to avoid them. So if you take a closer look at these, they're all sort of six-pointed star shapes. And within one picture, you see the one with the stones in it. That these are all from one picture, and they're all aligned in the same way with the camera frame. So I figured, you know, it must be something to do with the camera, maybe with the lens. So I started looking at approximately what my camera lens looks like, and it's a zoom lens, so it has a lot of different parts. This is a picture of a very, very simple zoom lens that just has an apocal zoom system, which consists of at least, you know, these three things where you move the middle one to change the focal length. And you have a focusing length at the end and sort of an image point at the end. So it has very many components. And you can imagine that a lot of internal reflections could happen, potentially. What this means is, you know, something comes in that is not actually inside the pre-image, something, you know, hits your lens that shouldn't end up in the image, but this is the pointer. This is the black line here, and then, you know, you want these types of blue lines that come from your pre-image, but this thing kind of scatters off inside the lens, and it has many opportunities to do so if you have many lenses inside your zoom. And if it's bright enough, you're going to see this odd point or flare in your final image. So these are the kinds of things that you get from that. This picture I did not take, but it has pretty impressive flare. But what you see here is that all of them are round because the source is circular. And the only sort of interesting geometry comes from the direction where the light is coming from, so they're kind of aligned in this way. But there's no points or anything like that. So this wasn't really what I was looking for, unfortunately. So what do my flares look like? They're right on bright objects, they're not from off image, and they're anisotropic. They have these six spikes, they're not just circular. Another clue that I found when I thought about it a little more was that they're always in the same orientation with respect to the camera, given that they have the same aperture settings. So I thought I'd take a look at the aperture. So cameras have a thing called a diaphragm in them, which consists of several blades that are circular segments. They're relatively flat, so if you have a large aperture, your thing is pretty much circular because they line up nicely. But if you close it more and go down to the order of millimeters, you get something that is distinctly not circular. You get something that's a hexagon, pentagon, something like that. And it kind of constricts the light beam that makes your image. And I found this nice image of a laser scattering through a hexagonal aperture, which looks a lot like my star thing. You know, and then I put a little hexagon on it, and it all seems to line up, so maybe this is what's happening. But then I wanted to look into what's actually going on and ask myself, do we have Fraunhofer diffraction? Do we have something different? And if you look at this, you have a near-field diffraction here and a far-field diffraction here, which basically means you're relatively close to the aperture here, far away from the aperture here, through a square aperture. And you see, if you're close to the aperture, you get the shape of the aperture, and within it, you get patterns. Whereas over here, you get a picture of the aperture and kind of things flaring out from it that depend in their direction on the geometry of your aperture, which is what I think is going on. So that's what's called Fraunhofer scattering. As far as I can tell from the parameters of my camera, this condition for Fraunhofer scattering isn't fulfilled. So I think I don't understand something about my camera here. But this is the kind of thing that is obviously going on, so I thought I'd go with that and looked up some more stuff. And it turns out in 1973, a paper was published on Fraunhofer scattering through polygonal apertures. And these guys did experiments. So these are results of, you know, just scattering lights through these kinds of apertures. And these are the theoretical predictions of what the light patterns would look like. This is a hexagonal aperture. This is actually a triangular aperture. And looks pretty much exactly like what I have. But both of them have a pattern where, you know, you have a sort of six-pointed geometry going on. So both of these are candidates for apertures in my camera that would create the images I see. As it turns out, these effects are pretty popular, and so other ways have been come up with to create them artificially without having to rely on your diaphragm creating a weird effect. So what people use a lot is a filter that has a diffraction grating in it, a very fine diffraction grating, and it creates these kinds of effects as an eight-pointed star. So you would have four different diffraction gratings that are overlaid. And the way this works is we all know about single slit diffraction. You have a single slit, point source shines on it, we get this kind of a shape. So if we overlay another grating on this one, we get another line of diffraction pattern. And the third one would give us a six-pointed star, very similar to the ones I saw without a filter. And the difference is that in the first image, my star points actually flare out a little bit, which is something that you wouldn't get with this kind of a filter. And finally, you know, these kinds of effects aren't only sometimes desires. People put filters on cameras. They're also, at this point, really popular in video games or animated movies. And they're sort of a way of making things look more realistic. You have like a big starburst here. You have these kind of off-image flares from stuff that, you know, this is some computer-generated image. So in conclusion, I learned that internal reflections can lead to all sorts of ghost images in your final picture. I learned that the non-circular nature of camera apertures can lead to other interesting diffraction effects like the ones that I observed at small apertures. I'm sure that it's Fraunhofer diffraction, but I don't understand my camera well enough to plug the right numbers into the condition, so I'd like to, you know, find out more about that. And you can use a diffraction grating to get a very similar effect. And I learned that my camera has either a hexagonal or a triangular diaphragm. So that's pretty interesting. I think triangular ones are pretty unusual, so it seems weird that it would have one like that. But yeah, it must be one of those two options. That's it. Thank you.
Lens flares?
So
they're solid. Right? They're not, they're not flared, right?
Right, so I think those happen, those are similar off-image type things where something passes through and then gets scattered. So something that wouldn't actually end up in your image, but is bright enough to light up your aperture and then gets, you know, backscattered and force scattered again and ends up as a ghost image of the shape of your diaphragm.
So it would be the shape.
Yeah.
What about, I assume it's a digital camera, what about the CCD itself?
I don't know much about that.
Okay, because the CCD, of course, also is a bunch of pixels. Not only that, they pick up color, the mosaic with which they pick up the different colors depends from brand to brand. So this is a huge problem in astronomy where they get similar things, but a lot of the streaks you get are, you know, I guess diffraction patterns, but also saturation effects on the CCD.
Oh, okay.
So oversaturating pixels on the CCD can also cause patterns, but I believe those are mostly like this.
Because you have a square grid.
Exactly, but that's for, I'm feeling where those in the case of astronomy where you're looking at intensity typically in one band. You have a color camera, so there's three colors, so that might also be a source of this. So I think the best thing to do is take your camera apart.
I was thinking about it last night, but I thought, you know, it's a bit risky. It's pretty new still. So.
Okay, let's thank my team. Our speaker of the day is James Reed, who, being a theoretical physicist, is going to tell us about space-time in a book.
Let's get myself plugged in. Okay, how's that? Not too loud? Oh, yeah, I'll move it down a bit. I'm loud anyway, so I don't really need this. Okay, here we go. Last one. Okay, is it left to go? Ah, okay, good. Right. Good morning, everyone. Okay, I thought I'd be in the morning. Good afternoon, everyone. As you can see from the title of my talk, I'm going to tell you how I saw an entire space-time on my bookshelf. Now, the fact that I'm holding a book called Modern Mathematical Physics may lead you to believe that this is going to be a mathematical talk. Quite on the contrary, because my main motivation, instead of speaking about maths, is to show that in many cases, the correct mathematics for a physical system stems from pure physical intuition. I'll give you an example of the converse first, however. When I was walking around and I was thinking about things to write about for my talk, I was looking around me and I saw some power cables up high, and I saw a long cable like this, and I saw one wrapped around it like that. And that reminded me of magnetic flux ropes and plasmas. So I had a pre-existing knowledge of physics, and I could see an analogy from that physics. Another example was I was looking at shadows of trees on the ground, and they just shimmered. And I looked at the shimmering as a whole and thought, wow, that looks like static on television. You know, it's a sort of maximally random pattern. So my point is, it's quite common for a physicist to know some physics and then see analogies in nature which relate to what he knows. But what I want to do is I want to show that an analogy in nature can lead us back to mathematics. And I think this is a very good skill for a physicist to have. So when I went to my bookshelf, what I saw was a two-dimensional space-time. It's a really bad bad image, because my camera died after I took one photo, so it's lucky I got. What I saw, page, was that each page of this book was a two-dimensional space frozen at a particular instant in time. The curvature of a page represented, as in Einstein's relativity, the force of gravity. Now, if I were some sort of two-dimensional bug living on the surface, I wouldn't know the space was curved. Instead, I would experience this force as gravity. Well, what's also good about this analogy is the fact that the pages stack to form a history. So we can imagine we have something like this. We have a curved space-time, and we can see each page as being like a time slice of the system. Now, this is an interesting way of looking at space-time. This is certainly a novel way. So, can we apply it to a real physical problem? Does this actually solve anything, looking at things in this manner? And the answer is yes, it certainly does. It solves the problem of creating a Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity. Now, that sounds intimidating, but I wouldn't worry. I'm not going to speak about that. Instead, we are going to intuit a very advanced piece of mathematics called foliation by considering simply how to move forward from one leaf of the foliation to the next. So this is what we have on this diagram here. And I want everyone to look at the bottom leaf of the foliation. On the leaf, we've defined a point particle. There it is. It's at a point xi. For those of you who aren't familiar with relativity, I is not a power. It's an index, and it runs over a dimension of space. So in this case, the set 1, 2, xy. And now, at this stage, we're on the foliation sigma t, sigma for space at a time t. We want to jump, however, to this leaf. We want to move forward in time to the new leaf, sigma at t plus dt. That's how far we move forward. So how do we do this? Obviously, we're going to move forward in time, but we have an extra factor of n coming in. This is quite intuitive as well, because if you think this is our foliation, this page and this page aren't necessarily, even though we're only one page apart, so we're only a time plus dt apart, they're not necessarily that, like in terms of real space-time distance. And so we have a function called the lapse function, which we basically quantify out. If we say, okay, it's maybe not exactly dt, let's pop in a function. We'll call it n. In terms of the movement of a particle, you can see that it's moved up to a new point, xi plus dxi. So in quantifying this, we introduce a vector called the shift vector. Now you'll see that the shift vector is actually on the old quantity. And this is because the old point where it started at is ni lots of dt further back from the new point. So remarkably, just by thinking in sort of waffly terms and making sure that all the dimensions fit, we've actually replicated a very advanced piece of mathematics. I mean, if I'd came up and I'd said, okay, imagine an integrable subbundle of the tangent bundle such that blah blah, you'd have all been lost. But showing in terms of an analogy can lead back to a concrete piece of mathematics. And I think this is a very important skill for a physicist to have. I mean, often it's quite hard to find an analogy. This is the only one I could think of. But it's very good if you're mathematically modeling an area which is unintuitive, an esoteric regime, like relativity or like quantum physics. And so I think that was what I basically said in my last slide. And with that, I'd like to finish and invite your questions. Thank you. any technical questions as well, like, because it wasn't a technical talk. Yeah. Yes, Joel.
Yeah, well, when you fool machines properly, the topology doesn't change. It's still not curvy. It's fine.
Yeah, well, okay, in the example of a book, yes, it's flat. It is Minkowski. If we imagined a curved book, I suppose it would be better if I can do that. And if a geometry can evolve, this is the basis of what's called the Arnott-Deser-Misner formulation of relativity. But a book is as good an analogy as I could think of. My main point, really, was the fact that we can think about mathematics from a physical point of view as well. And this is the skill of a physicist, as I believe it. It's seeing the correct, well, understanding which mathematics we'll use in describing nature, or in formulating different theories. Fair enough.
Well, actually, I think there's probably still some work to do.
So make sure that when you guys are finished with these sheets that you hand them back, if you give them to Callum or to Dennis, and then we'll collate all the information and get it all back to you. So I'm going to do that right this instant. I want to make a couple of points. I thought the quality of the presentations was extremely high. I was really, really blown away by it. I would say that three-quarters of you or so are forming at a level that I would say is much higher than what you typically see at a conference. So please take some of this to heart and apply it when you're going to conferences and presenting your research. You can have a huge impact. It's really, really amazingly well done. I'm not sure there's any other concept or things I want to mention. I think that's all. I hope you enjoyed this week. I've certainly very much enjoyed interacting with you guys. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I wish you tons of luck in the remainder of the year. There are some gifts at the back here, which not from me, but sort of, well, anyway. It comes down to it's a book that I thought was rather cute. I mean, the best thing to do is just pick it up on your way out. It's a rather cute book. It's written by Nijen, this Nobel laureate whose name I mentioned before. It is just a bunch of very short little stories about different scientists that he came across during his career. And he just describes the personality, just like sort of one, two-page stories. Doesn't say who they actually are. They're just sort of people that have come through his life and their different characteristics. And I think what you'll find when you read it, certainly when I do, is that I recognize myself and a whole bunch of different people, and a whole bunch of people say, oh yeah, I do that, yeah, I do that. Shit, I wish I did not do that. I should avoid that in the future. So anyway, I hope you enjoy that read.
Okay, so before we break up for the day, we have a tradition of giving a gift to our lecturers. We have these very nice Perimeter Scholars International t-shirts. Now, Kari is the first lecturer to be here for a second time. What I don't remember is whether we had the t-shirts when you were here last year.
We did.
So this is your second Perimeter Scholars International t-shirt, which I will give to you. I hope it's a good size. I should mention, actually, we are expecting a new crop of PSI t-shirts, so you can also lay claim.